I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Thanksgiving. Later in the hour, we'll take our annual pilgrimage to see the snow geese in Vermont. We'll also check in on a longtime Alabama football rivalry, and we'll have the latest news again at the half hour. But we want to start with a story of why the pilgrims are so deeply important to an African-American minister who is, as far as we know, the only black American to enter the cloistered world of the prestigious Pilgrim Society and the Old Colony Club, groups largely made up of descendants of pilgrims and the keepers of their flame.
The breaking waves dashed high on a stern and rock-bound coast where a band of exiles moored their bark on the lone New England shore. Not as the conqueror comes, they, the true-hearted, came.
That's Reverend Peter Gomes, a nationally recognized minister and Harvard Divinity School professor. How did he become a pilgrim scholar, able to recite Felicia Dorothea Heman's Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers at the drop of a hat? He's certainly not a descendant, but he grew up in Plymouth, and he is proudly a man of contradictions, Republican and gay, black, and fascinated with pilgrims, something we first learned through historian Bruce Feiler's book, America's Prophet, which is about Moses' connection to the pilgrims. We recently met Reverend Gomes outside his Harvard University home, where he lives when he's not in Plymouth.
Glad you're here.
May we come into your abode?
You certainly may.
It's very yellow.
Be noticed in the wintertime against the snow.
There you go.
That is why barns in New England were painted yellow, red, and green, so they could be seen against the snow.
Oh, isn't this lovely?
Well, come in.
The 19th-century Harvard-owned Treadwell Sparks House is an academic's dream. Book-lined shelves, sparkling chandeliers, old wooden floors, busts of classical figures.
Then here is the great double room.
And several hundred-year-old portraits of straight-backed early white Americans. What do people say to you, Reverend Gomes? And they come in here and...
Well, they come in here and they say, are these your ancestors?
They're all
they don't
white.
They don't know what else to say. And I say, they could be. Why not? Now, you've all heard of Thomas Jefferson, haven't you? These are just people that I happen to like. I don't know who they are.
You have, a close-knit group of black friends.
But I say to them, don't deprive yourself of this great inheritance, which belongs to us all.
We settled in the study and asked him to tell us more.
I know that I'm an African-American and I'm not an Anglo-Saxon, and the pilgrims were Anglo-Saxons. And so in theory, there should be a great divide. But I didn't feel this great divide. I thought they were just the first citizens of the town I live in, and I have an obligation to find out as much about them as I can. And I claimed them. I said, they belong to me. I may not belong to them, but they belong to me. They were a part of the world that I was inheriting, and I was interested in them.
And you say your parents were a little hesitant about this on your part, maybe even afraid that you might be hurt because they were not like you?
That's far more the point. They were afraid that when I discovered, in one way or another, that I wasn't a pilgrim, that it would be a devastation to me. I remember once I had a part. I was Governor Bradford in our sixth grade pilgrim play, and I had a pilgrim costume and whatnot. Oh, it was great fun. And my father said to my mother, he didn't know that I overheard him, he thinks he's a pilgrim. And poor father thought that when I discovered that I wasn't a pilgrim, I was going to be destroyed. It would be a terrible thing. Well, it wasn't.
In your father's mind, they were white, exclusive, they were Yankee.
That's right.
In your mind, they were what? Because you actually saw how much they were like you.
Yes, I did. They were white, they were Yankees, but they had virtues and values that I appreciated. Yeah. So why should I be deprived of them, I thought.
Were there many African-American young people in Plymouth when you were growing up?
Well, there was an African-American community in Plymouth, and there had been for a very long time. I think you could describe them, we, as black Yankees. They were all very middle class. They were mailmen, firemen, policemen, small property owners. The white people, by and large, had more money, but I don't think there was any class resentment or anything of that sort. In some sense, almost a totally integrated world run by Yankee values. All the black Plymouthians spoke and sounded like white Plymouthians. If you were in a room, close the door, you couldn't tell who was white, who was black. People are always curious why I don't sound like Jesse Jackson. And I say there was no Jesse Jackson in Plymouth. Well, the combination of being brought up in Plymouth and going to school in Maine, you end up sounding like me, which confounds an awful lot of people I know. Who is this person? He's black. He doesn't sound black to me. Well, that's your problem, not mine. And there really was prejudice in Plymouth, I'm sure of it. And my parents were very much aware of it and were determined to protect me from it. But I, personally, was never discriminated against. If anything, I was sort of favored. When I was in high school, I was given a job at the Plymouth Public Library, and one of my jobs was to deal with the genealogical inquiries that came in. The librarian saw that I had an interest in history, and she gave me my head. I was allowed to do all sorts of things. I wrote the article on Plymouth for the Encyclopedia Americana. You know, I had a publication, and I was in the 11th grade. It was pretty impressive, so it seemed to be. And from that job, I went to work for summers at the Pilgrim Society. And I became very much involved in Pilgrim research and Pilgrim work there. I'm still associated with that society.
You're past president.
Oh, yes. I went all the way up. I did everything. 40 years I've been involved with them.
Were there other African Americans in the Pilgrim Society?
Not that I knew of. I think I was the only one. I was the first one. And it didn't seem unusual to me, though I think there are many people who thought it was rather peculiar, but nobody ever said anything. I remember one day, and I was working at the front desk in high summer, my very first year there, having had my father's warning that these people, will, you know, they don't like you, you'll be surprised. And he was trying to prepare me for the worst. One day, the president of the Pilgrim Society, Ellis W. Brewster himself, God on earth, came in, and he stood at the front desk, and he looked at me, and he said, "Are you a member of the Pilgrim Society?" And I thought I was going to be fired on the spot. I said, "No, sir." He said, "Well, you know, we can't have non-members working here." He reached into his pocket and gave me a life membership in the Pilgrim Society, which he himself had signed. One of the nicest things that ever happened to me. I went home and I told my father. My father couldn't believe it till I showed him this document with Ellis W. Brewster's signature on it. And, you know, I think father began to have second thoughts.
Tell me also about the other narrative, which you said is as important as the narrative of your family. The Pilgrims had escaped oppression. They had been discriminated against.
Well, they came to a new world. They started a new culture and a new civilization, and they really felt that God had a special mission for them in the world. They were going to pursue it. Well, so too did my people in many ways, and I thought the two stories came together very nicely.
In speaking to author Bruce Feiler, he shows us how the Pilgrims in escaping an oppressor, crossing a body of water, finding freedom, we're repeating the Moses story.
Oh, yes. The Pilgrims became new Jews. There weren't very many Jews for them to deal with anyway, so they sort of took over the Old Testament and the Jewish narrative as their own. They had left Egypt, Europe. They had crossed the Red Sea, the Atlantic Ocean. They entered into the Promised Land, and, you know, they saw themselves as a part of this whole thing.
That is something you identified with.
That story is a universal one, and if they could adapt it, so too could I.
And you were an African-American.
Yes. I saw no contradiction. Now, I know there are many who did and perhaps still do, but I didn't see any.
It's interesting because we're reminded that while we celebrate that part of the story, crossing the river, escaping oppression, we forget that there's more to the arc of the story, which is that Moses never found the Promised Land.
That's right. The Pilgrims were much more fortunate than poor old Moses. They got there, they built it, they created a world for themselves. It was not meant for Moses to do that, but he was to be succeeded by those who did.
But did the Pilgrims see themselves as successful, ultimately?
Some did, some didn't. Poor old Governor Bradford is rather melancholy in his history, you know. We went through all this, and our children are leaving us, and they're settling in far distant places, and will we succeed or not? He has a sort of low view of all that's going on. The first generation were rather frustrated, I think.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but they were very singular. You had to... It wasn't just freedom they were after, it was conforming to their religious beliefs.
Well, their idea was, you know, not to provide a value-free or a neutral-free society. They wanted a society after their own lights. And so, of course, they'd be unhappy when people left it. And, of course, they'd do everything they could to enforce their views and their values. That was their enterprise. And we do them an injustice when we think that their purpose was simply to found a value-free place where everybody could do what everybody wanted. No, they wanted a place where they could do as they felt was right. Sometimes it meant that you were forced to do things you'd rather not do. They were not the easiest people to live with, I guess.
And you've said, too, I want to see if I get this right, that idea of success, you get to the promised land, failure, you know, a bad winter, or you lose, you know, a younger generation moves out. That cycle is a part of their story.
They understood what frustration and failure was, and they understood that being faithful to God meant being faithful in bad times as well as in good times. They often felt that the bad times were testing of their spirits, and that if they could get through the difficulties and the difficult days, they would be rewarded by good days.
The Moses narrative that the Puritans felt they were fulfilling has also been repeated by Americans over the last several hundred years, including Martin Luther King, who quoted Moses, and the African Americans on the Underground Railroad, who felt they were also crossing some sort of a...
And they were.
That Jewish narrative is universal. People moving from a certain kind of uncertainty and confusion forward to something that is promised them, towards which they are setting their goals and ambitions. So that Jewish narrative belongs to everybody in a remarkable sense. We're all Jews. We're all the children of Moses. We're all moving from Egypt into the promised land. I mean, it's the whole American story. All those Middle Europeans coming here in the 19th century, in the early 20th century. I mean, it's the great tale.
As an African American, what do you say to people that say that the Indians were, the Native American Indians were supplanted by the Pilgrims?
Oh, we have to deal with this all the time. History has winners and losers. The Pilgrims and the first generation of Indians got along very well. It's only later on that things began to deteriorate. And I argue that the Indians and the Pilgrims were probably better friends to each other in the 17th century than they have been in the 20th century. So I think, given the history of conquest in America, the Pilgrims and the Indians got on very well indeed. The Indians were not altogether sure of these white people, and the white people were not altogether sure of the Indians. But for 50 years, they got along without killing each other, which was better than any other encounter in this country of ours. So I think even the Indian history is one of which there is some degree of pride and responsibility in the first generation.
But even with that Pilgrim's pride, as Reverend Gomes indicated, the Pilgrims in the end felt they failed. They didn't create a biblical fellowship. And that's where Peter Gomes sees in the Pilgrim's story his own, sees America's revolution followed by slavery, a civil war followed by segregation. When we come back, we'll hear more and have a trip to Plymouth at the half hour of the latest news. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Reverend Peter Gomes, a Harvard theology professor and Pilgrim scholar. In fact, Reverend Gomes is a former president of the Pilgrim Society. And during our visit, he also told us about a lesser-known group, the Old Colony Club, what author Bruce Feiler calls a self-appointed Thanksgiving Protection Society.
Now, the Old Colony Club was founded in 1769, a group of men who were unhappy with the way the Pilgrims were being commemorated, usually in drunken taverns, and they decided they were going to form a society that was a little bit more sober and focused.
We understand they also row out in July to celebrate what they see as almost an accidental first Thanksgiving on something called Clark's Island off of Plymouth. What's that?
Well, there was a wonderful island in Plymouth Harbor, which was the very first landing place as they were exploring this end of the world. The Pilgrims left Provincetown and explored Plymouth Harbor, were wrecked on Clark's Island. And in the summertime, there's usually a clam bake or some gathering, and the Old Colony Club is invited out, and they go out in flotillas of boats, and they, in general, think they're having a good time. I don't want to give encouragement to the notion that the first Thanksgiving took place on Clark's Island. It didn't. I'm sure they were grateful, and I'm sure they ate, but it takes more than that to constitute Thanksgiving.
What do you think of our notion of Thanksgiving?
Well, I think it's a wonderful notion. I think of all of our holidays, it's the only one that is peculiar and native to us. And I think it has to do with family and gathering together and being grateful for mercies and a sense of renewal.
And what do you find yourself thinking on Thanksgiving, given, going back to the beginning of your story that you told us about, your parents' fear that if you became too fascinated with the pilgrims, you would be hurt. And then there you go, all the way to the president of the Pilgrim Society.
As an African-American man, I'm always very grateful that I live in Plymouth, Massachusetts. I'm very grateful that Thanksgiving is something that I have known all my life, and it makes me feel very proud to be an American. It doesn't draw any separate line in the sand for me. In fact, it confirms my identity as a legitimate citizen of this republic. And I really like to believe that in Plymouth, within sight of my house, all that was good about our republic began. I like that. My parents got it wrong. Their boy is as much a pilgrim as John Alden or William Bradford. And they, I think, ought to be. They're gone now, but that ought to please them. But they live in a different world. It was a different sentiment then.
Reverend Gomes, what are you going to eat on Thanksgiving?
What I always eat. Cranberry sauce, pumpkin pie, turkey, stuffing, the whole thing.
Well, have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. Thanksgiving is no day to experiment. Take part in what is trustworthy, true, and good. That's what I always say.
And get your cranberries from Plymouth.
That's right. Don't mess with the recipes either. The kids will tell you that.
Reverend Peter Gomes. Meanwhile, in Plymouth, his hometown, people are not messing with the recipes at Plymouth Plantation, the living museum, which faithfully recreates early pilgrim life. Yes, they have a behind-the-scenes modern kitchen, but every year, visitors sample a pottage of cabbage, leeks, and onions, a fricassee of fish, or stewed pompion, fare found at the first Thanksgiving.
I'm not really sure what I'm expecting as far as a menu. I'm assuming that it's going to be traditional pilgrim food, which I don't even know what that is, but I'm looking forward to trying it.
I'm Kathleen Wall. I'm a Colonial Foodways culinarian at Plymouth Plantation. We start looking at 17th century English cookbooks. We look at paintings. Then we present those to our modern chef, and he says, well, that's really nice, but I can't get that. You know, passenger pigeon, really hard to come by.
My name is Ken Randall. I'm the executive chef at Plymouth Plantation. This dish is mussels seethed with parsley and beer.
There are also costume role players who are there to help give a sense of the past.
Do you know your table manners? Put your napkin upon your lap. Yes, like that.
Just like so.
Yes, now. Don't spit on the table, across the table, but you can spit under the table.
My name is Andrea. I'm eating roast beef, pork. I'm eating with my hands because that's what the pilgrims did.
There's two courses that we serve it in, which is a very common banquet style for 17th century dinners. But there's a whole variety of foods in each course, and so you put down a whole lot of different sorts of foods, and then you take them away, and then you do it again. So it's not setting courses like a modern dinner where the soup is first, and then the main course, the entree, and then dessert afterwards. So you have sweet things in with the savory things. So it's a slightly different presentation of food.
My favorite dish was the dark meat turkey, because I like turkey. I also liked the fish. It had a nice, like, onion taste to it.
In the second course, there's a fricassee of fish that has a sauce of leeks fried up with ginger sprinkled on top of it. And that's actually a very medicinal way of looking at fish. Fish is cold and wet in its nature, and the ginger is hot and dry. And so now you've balanced that dish. This is how you balance a meal in the 17th century, by the Aristotle's doctrine of humors, not by veg and carbs and meat.
It's really cool to see the silverware they used and the plates and how it feels and the recipes they used and also the people and the songs they sang.
Come
from the sea. We spend our lives in jeopardy whilst others live at ease.
I'm Greg Rosner, and what I'm doing here is just getting a taste of history. It's more than just the food that we ate. It's talking to people who really understand who and what and how these people lived.
Our visit to Plymouth Plantation was produced by Here and Now intern Margaret Airy. Later in the show, American troops on a tense border in Iraq. That's after the news, Here and Now. American military forces are marking their sixth Thanksgiving in Iraq with turkey dinners and calls to loved ones back home. Overall, violence is down in Iraq since last year, but a number of recent bombings and attacks have raised fears about the eventual withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq, which is scheduled for late next year. The recent violence is also straining relations between Iraq and Syria. Iraq says many of the attackers are from Syria, including those involved in a bombing that killed more than 150 people in Baghdad in October. Syria denies the claim, but the BBC's Jim Muir has been with American soldiers patrolling Iraq's border with Syria. Their mission is to stop militants from coming in.
A1, this is 6. Do you read me?
I'm Specialist David Bishop from 1-4 Cav. The next 2 days, we'll be interdicting people in the Syrian border.
Who are these people you're interdicting?
Really? Syrians are trying to come into Iraq. That aren't supposed to be here. And there's a lot of smuggling going on between both sides.
Do you get something every time you go out?
We don't get something every time we go out. It all depends. You're only a small unit. Can't cover everywhere.
So you're not having shootouts every night then?
No, not at all.
Well, this is the actual border. There's something like a 3-meter, 10-foot deep trench on the other side of which, about 30, 40 meters away, there's a berm. It's a kind of earth wall that runs all the way along this border here. And the Americans who are on this particular stretch, they've been checking into this ditch, looking for footprints on the berm, signs of people trying to come across from Syria. It's really not the easiest place in the world to get across. Borders are porous. This one is no exception, but they're certainly not making it easier. There's a couple of American Apache helicopters who've been hovering over the area, and they've tipped off the patrol here that some dunes that we have here in the desert just close to the border may be suspicious. They seem to have some possible signs of activity around them, so the patrol is going to take a closer look at that.
We got some shovels in the trucks. We're going to dig into one of these little sand mounds and see if there's anything. Most likely it's just natural occurrence from the wind and blowing over. Strange things happen out in the desert, so...
But it could be arms caches.
Yeah, there's a possibility it could always be a cache.
Well, that was one false alarm. Let's go off in chase of another.
It's the helicopters. They said that they saw some bags down the road a little bit, and so we decided we're going to go check it out. They're saying they think it's probably just some feed in a centralized location.
Yeah, it's drug dung they use as a fertilizer.
Oh, is that?
It looks like it.
Fertilizer?
Well, it just shows that nothing much moves around here without being checked out by the Americans, and more often than not, obviously, these prove to be false alarms.
First Lieutenant Nicholas Grotevant, during our time here, which is in the past 21 days now, we've caught 3 border crossers. There's a very good likelihood that they were just normal people trying to smuggle cigarettes across the border to pay for their families.
Do you feel in a sense that you may be wasting your time a bit with a lot of false alarms?
We are assisting the Iraqi Border Patrol with our capabilities of night vision, having air assets, things that they do not have. If we weren't here, there is definitely a potential that something else could be coming across the border. And so I think that we are still making a difference in deterring people crossing the border.
after our border trip. On our way out, we passed by the local headquarters of the Iraqi border police. The commander there wasn't able to speak to us on the record, but he confirmed what other Iraqi officers have told us, which is that in the last 8 or 9 months, they haven't detained a single infiltrator coming across the border who they believe to be a militant terrorist or whatever. So the impression given by the Iraqi prime minister that the Syrians are allowing a flow of fighters, guns, and material across the border certainly doesn't seem to hold true, at least in this section of the border.
That report from the BBC's Jim Muir in Iraq. Tomorrow on Here and Now, if you're one of those who heads out looking for a bargain, buyer beware. Maybe buying something good once is better than buying something cheap over and over. Also, could new safety regulations put small toy makers out of business? Up next, one of the country's oldest Thanksgiving Day football rivalries, Here and Now. This is a day of traditions, and that includes football rivalries. The Alabama State University Hornets will meet the Tuskegee University Golden Tigers in the 86th Turkey Day Classic later today at Cramden Bowl in Montgomery, Alabama. This is the oldest football classic among the country's historically black colleges and universities. Reggie Barlow coaches Alabama State. He's on the line from Montgomery. Coach Barlow, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Willie Slater, head football coach at Tuskegee. He joins us from Tuskegee, Alabama. Coach Slater, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Coach Slater, I'm really sorry to do this, but I want to start with a look back. Last year, your team, Tuskegee, undefeated going into that game. Coach Barlow's Alabama State team scored an upset, 17-13. It was Tuskegee's only loss of the season. You still feeling it?
Oh yeah, you feel those. That game had a lot of implications behind it. We might have had a chance to win the Black College National Championship again. Our quarterback hadn't lost the game his whole starting career.
And given that it's a rivalry, what does it do for you today, Coach Barlow? Do you go in and tell your guys, remember last year? I mean, Tuskegee again this year has an 8-2 record. They're going to a bowl game. You're Alabama State Hornets, 4-6. So going in today, do you have to pump your guys up to remember last year?
Well, not really. I mean, you know, this game has been going on for a long time, and both teams, they understand and know what this game means to both universities. So both teams will be pumped up. Last year it came down to the last play. Year before that it was 2 or 3 overtime. So, you know, the team that plays to the final second is off the clock will probably be the team that win the game.
That's Coach Reggie Barlow of Alabama State. And we're reminded you were once a star player on the team. So this rivalry goes way back for you before you were a coach. Can you compare it to other rivalries, say Michigan and Ohio State?
Well, I haven't been a part of the Michigan-Ohio State. I know, you know, down here, Alabama and Auburn University. Those are huge rivalry games here. And this one here is the same way. You know, I grew up in this city and grew up actually a Tuskegee fan, you know, and had the opportunity to come to Alabama State and be a part of this game for 4 years. And so I know what it means on both ends. And, you know, we just got to sell that over to our players and let them know that they're, you know, they're not playing for themselves, but they're playing for many, many people who've come before.
It's Coach Reggie Barlow of Alabama State. Coach Slater, Willie Slater of Tuskegee, you were also a star on your college team, but that was West Alabama. Now, what's your sense of this rivalry?
I really didn't understand the significance of the rivalry until last year. When we lost the game, that's when it really, you know, hit me in the face. Felt like we let our fans down and we let ourselves down. At the same time, that's no disrespect to Alabama State because they have a very good football team just like they do this year.
Well, as we said, this is the 86th Turkey Day Classic, and I think your schools have been in, 70 of them or something like that.
Yeah, I can actually, this is Coach Slater from Tuskegee. My first college football game that I ever went to in my life was Alabama State and Tuskegee. Mm-hmm. So it goes back a long way in my heritage as well.
And now you get to be the coach. By the way, either of you jump in. When you step on the field, do you know it's Thanksgiving? You know, it's different?
I do. I mean, you know, it's the cooking and all that stuff is going on, so you do know it's Thanksgiving. But Thanksgiving dinner don't go down well when you're not successful on Thanksgiving Day. So,
But Willie Slater, when you step on that field, aside from you know, the meal aspect. Are you aware that this is a different game? Does it feel different on Rivalry Day?
Thanksgiving, to me, is a day of Thanksgiving. I have that part, but then when I get to the game, that's a different ball game because that's my job. Yeah. So I have to work on Thanksgiving Day.
That's Willie Slater, who coaches the Tuskegee University football squad. They're going to be meeting Reggie Barlow's Alabama State Hornets in the 86th annual Turkey Day Classic this afternoon in Montgomery, Alabama, by the way. It'll be broadcast on ESPNU for university. Coaches, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, we have something of a Thanksgiving tradition of our own at Here and Now. Every year we revisit a trip we made to Vermont with my Uncle Locke to see the annual migration of the snow geese. We're going to have that story for you again this year, but it got us wondering, how are those snow geese? So we called up David Sawsville. He's a wildlife biologist with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. David, we know you're on your cell phone, and I understand you're at Dead Creek in Addison, Vermont?
Yes, I am. I'm out in the middle of the refuge with several thousand snow geese right now.
How does it look?
It's beautiful. It's a field of white.
A field of white. That's what they look. They're all on the ground then?
They are. They haven't flown out yet this afternoon for their afternoon feeding, and they're just loafing on the refuge portion of the wildlife management area.
Well, we know this isn't the peak time of year, but that, you know, that number, that would seem down from, for instance, when we were there. How has the migration of the snow geese changed?
Within Dead Creek itself, our numbers peaked back around 1999 to 2001, where we would have 20,000 birds stop at one time. And over the last couple of years, that has decreased to 3,000 to 5,000 just here on the wildlife area.
Why is that?
The birds have shifted their migrational patterns. They're spending more time up in upstate New York, where they're finding a lot of high-energy foods in the cornfields that are up there. And much of our corn is harvested for or silage for cows earlier now. So farming practices have changed, and the geese have adapted.
Well, but you've told us something interesting. There may be less birds migrating, but more snowbirds in general, and that's not necessarily a good thing. Why?
The snow geese in our area, as you said, have decreased, but within the Atlantic Flyway, the population has grown to almost 1.4 million breeding individuals now.
Wow.
And yeah, it's an incredible jump, and our hope is to actually have that population reduced down to around 500,000 birds.
Why is that such a problem to have, millions as opposed to half a million?
The number of birds are going to affect the quality of the habitat where they're nesting, and we're worried about a major crash within the population, and we'd like to have a nice stable population where they will be able to sustain themselves.
Well, meanwhile, I'm wondering, I know the state built a dirt road, so it's easier for people to come to Dead Creek and watch the birds. Are they still an important tradition for families in that area?
They are still a big tradition. We have families coming up to see the birds because, you know, even at 3,000 birds, it's quite the sight to see them all at once and when they lift off and start calling to each other. So it is a big tradition, and, you know, usually they start showing up around that first or second weekend in October, and they peak mid-October, and we'll have them stay here all the way through into November, December, as long as we have unfrozen water and open land without snow for them to come on and forage in.
David Sawsville, wildlife biologist with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. David, thanks so much for letting us know how things are going there.
Thank you.
And when we come back, let's go see the snow geese here and now. Welcome back. Before the break, we heard how the almost all-white migrating snow geese aren't landing in Vermont as much as they used to. This year's flocks number around 3,000. That's compared to 20,000 less than a decade ago. And that's how I'll always remember them. That's right around the time we first made a pilgrimage to Vermont to see my uncle Lachlan McLaughlin Field and the geese. Both of them slowly leaving us. Uncle Locke was 88 at the time, had just begun a bout with Alzheimer's. He passed away right around Thanksgiving in 2004 at the age of 91. And every November, my thoughts turn north to Vermont, to him, and to the snow geese. The snow geese, thousands of them, touch down every fall at a refuge called Dead Creek. My Uncle Locke had taken me there once to see the brown Canadian geese, but I wanted to see the snows. My cousin Peggy kept writing this fall, telling me that the snows had arrived. Finally, I got the subtext of her postcard. The leaves were falling. The snow geese would soon be leaving. And at 88, it's not like my uncle was going to wait around forever either. So up to Vermont we went.
Uncle Locke?
No.
Hi.
Hello.
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
My uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, looms large in my branch of the family. We were from the suburbs of New York. He collected arrowheads and with his son carved duck decoys. He and my late Aunt Martha spent years in the war, then came to Middlebury where he taught high school art. To us, he was General Patton meets Norman Rockwell.
I can't drive the car anymore. I haven't been out of this. I haven't seen you. You're the first person I've seen in this house in 2 weeks.
No.
That's true.
Well, hardly. It's just that at 88, Uncle Locke recently had to give up cross-country skiing. He's not painting as much.
Sit around. Vegetate.
Not today. We're going to geese.
She's a pro. What, in case someone steals it?
When was the last time you heard an alarm up here?
I gotta go.
So, off to Dead Creek, about a 20-minute drive from Middlebury. And on the way, we would do what relatives do this time of year, whether convening to go see a bird or to eat one. We just talked.
Ah, so, have you been following all the news? You know, all the fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm gonna tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. It's been going on for years. Slow down, because you're going to go across the traffic that goes that way. You go straight.
Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all alone, I held them up. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
Tell me about Dead Creek. I've been trying to explain it, that it's sort of a resting place where the migratory birds?
Yeah, it's right on the big flyway from north to south. So they flock in there. I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe. But no guarantee this time that they're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they aren't going to hang around.
I know.
They go through sometimes and by the thousands. I saw one day I walked out in the backyard. And snow geese are going by. Mm. They were low, very, very, very low, and they're way back of the house. They were flying single file. And I bet you the line of them was probably 3 football field lengths.
Really?
Yeah. So I got I watched this big chain going. It's up over the top of the trees, down, down, down. Never seen it since.
Huh.
Sometimes you can hear them coming. All honking away. Sound exactly like that, if you want to know.
They do. Okay, Uncle Locke, we just saw a sign, Dead Creek Wildlife Management. And the good news is I see some cars up ahead. I see.
See? A lot of times the geese get out in there. See?
Okay.
Right. There they go. See them?
Yep. All right, now
look at the cars here.
Yeah, I know.
Well, that means a lot of geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese.
At Dead Creek, we met up with my cousins and Brian Pfeiffer, a member of the Vermont Audubon Society, who runs several bird tours.
We're seeing regularly Ross's goose. It's a small version of a snow goose. And people think that we're nuts, you know, because we come out here and we look for one Ross's goose. But it's also...
Give me the name of that thing again.
Ross's, R-O-S-S. R-O-S-S apostrophe S.
Yeah, okay.
Ross's goose.
Huh?
Yeah. Small. They're out here.
Yeah, I want to see one now.
Yeah,
see,
so do I.
Hey, but look, I'm looking up there. I'm way up, much higher than the others we've seen. There's a V forming. Are they leaving?
Also, if you look right over the parking lot here, is a bird that's hovering. That's a red-tailed hawk hovering. But yes, those birds are leaving. You notice the V formation?
Yeah.
You see how one arm of the V is longer than the other?
Yeah.
They've actually figured out why that is.
What?
The longer arm has more geese in it.
Oh, my God.
hundreds, thousands of them. Uncle Locke, look, thousands.
Around,
yeah.
Here they come.
Wow, this is the best way to look at them.
I will never forget the look on my uncle's face. He'd put on my cousin's cape because of the cold, and when the birds rose up, probably because of that hawk, so did he. It was as if the ground where the snow geese were had been covered with snow, and then someone scooped it all up and threw it in the air like confetti.
One great fall experience. And you had it. I mean, when they all flew over your heads, you know, I mean, that's just... I live for that every fall.
But I saw the snow geese one time going by down through Cornwall.
Yeah.
Looked out back, and it was nothing but a thin white line.
Yes.
As far as you could see. And tree height. Far south as you see.
Okay. We're getting frozen.
That's right. Woo!
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, pretty nice. Yeah, I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have. But I saw the look on your face when that group lifted up.
Oh, it's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
With weather like this, they'll be taken off out of here. They'll be gone.
Yeah.
When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
When you want to get something to eat?
Do I want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
A return visit to the snow geese of Vermont with my late uncle, Lachlan McLachlan Field, who passed away in 2004 at the age of 91. I think of him often, especially when I see a line of geese stretched across the sky.
A thin white line, as far as you can see, and tree height. Just one long column of them. When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.